and welcome to Philadelphia Focus. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Rob Reichert, Executive Director for AIDS Fund Philly here in Philadelphia, and Dr. John Stern, an infectious disease specialist at Pennsylvania Hospital. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Obviously, we are here because coming up on October 20th, the annual AIDS Walk Philly will be happening. It provides vital funding for amazing things here in this region. But so let's get started today with, and this is going to sound like a really stupid question, but what is AIDS? What is HIV?
Well, it's a viral infection that was finally identified and nailed down in the early 80s. It infects humans and depletes the immune system over a number of years. Once one's immune system is sufficiently depleted, that's a loss of the T cells, patients become at risk for a variety of infections that humans don't normally suffer from. There's a lot of sort of scientific terminology which I can get into if you like, but the point is that AIDS is the development of these infections in the setting of lost immunity.
So we do not die of HIV. We don't, you know, you do not die of AIDS. You die of something that has, because of your compromised system, has taken advantage of you.
Exactly, yeah.
And it seems stupid to ask this at this point, but we are now how many years into our current lifestyle? I mean, we've had AIDS now since 1981. There's a whole generation who's grown up not knowing life before this crisis.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the things we were talking about before we started was, you know, the importance of getting out and talking to high schools and colleges about the epidemic, because they did grow up knowing about HIV. Unlike, you know, people of my generation who went through high school never hearing of it. So it's important that we continue to get the information out to high schools and colleges, make sure they're getting accurate information. And, you know, they have a different experience with the epidemic than those of us who are a little older. But I think they still have an understanding of the seriousness of the epidemic.
Do they, John? Do they? You talk to kids.
Yes, I think they do. But just to jump in on the epidemiology of this, probably for the first 15 years until 1995, most people felt that it was a death sentence. And, you know, we buried probably 500,000 people. Now, with the advent of a variety of medications, the cocktail it's referred to, where you can take one pill with three drugs and essentially shut the viral infection down, people are living virtually normal life expectancies. The data suggests that probably if you're well treated, you might live 4 years less than if you were not HIV infected. So that the problem is that because people at risk are aware that this has become at least a treatable disease and perhaps in the near future a curable disease, they've sort of let their guard down about becoming infected and figuring, well, I'll just take one of these pills a day and life will go on. Unfortunately, the pills have toxicities. Even with well-treated HIV, there are a variety of problems, particularly coronary artery disease, increase in certain cancers, particularly lung cancer, lymphomas, and it's very expensive. It costs somewhere in the range of about $30,000 per year per patient. And lastly, we are still seeing 35,000 new cases per year of HIV in the country.
Well, let's talk about infection now. 30 years into this, are we seeing a new population that are being infected?
Well, we're seeing the same populations that have kind of always been impacted. We're actually starting to see a decline in the number of new infections among heterosexuals and declines in number of new infections among intravenous drug users. Where we're seeing the increases is in men who have sex with men, particularly young gay and bisexual men. We're seeing increases in the new infections. So while we have, we're starting to see some declines in some populations, we're not seeing it across the board.
Are the infections, though, are they racially or ethnically disproportionate?
Very much so. If you are an African-American man who has sex with men in Philadelphia, currently the data suggests that you have a 50% chance of becoming HIV positive during their lifetime. So the African-American community of gay men are particularly hard hit by this this infection.
And what about other populations? Is it rising in Hispanic, Latino?
Also disproportionately impacted, not to the degree of the African-American community, but we do see the Latino community being disproportionately infected also.
Why is this? And again, you go out and you talk in public. You go out to groups and do outreach, John.
Well, that's, you know, I'm not a sociologist. I'm an infectious disease specialist. And that issue, I think, strikes at sociology of the African-American community in Philadelphia. But I'll weigh in on this a little bit. And I think that in the African-American community, both in Philadelphia and other metropolitan areas, it is very difficult for an African-American man to say, I am gay. It is really kind of a white term, not a black term. And as a result, black men have to really hide their homosexuality. Sometimes they're married, live a heterosexual life with children, and don't share the fact that they're having sex with men. They are not using condoms. They'll have unsafe sex. They'll bring it home to their sexual partners, their female sexual partners. It's not an issue that's talked about in African-American churches. And it's quite a mess. And from my perspective, I don't quite know how to tackle it. I know a number of people have been addressing it and thinking about it. But I think that that may at least share some of the reasons as to why the African-American community is disproportionately affected.
The other thing that I think is important to recognize is that once a virus takes hold in any community, you're more likely to, as one of my colleagues once said, stumble upon it. And so it becomes, you know, as there's more virus in a community, and that's the epidemiological perspective, it's more likely that the virus is going to spread in that community. So it becomes very much almost a self-fulfilling thing.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, yeah, I understand that. So, and I know that one of the things that you have emphasized for years is knowing your status. Jump in.
Yeah, well, knowing your status is critical to ending the epidemic, getting into treatment and care. It's the first step. And so we're, you know, really emphasize people getting tested. If people are listening and want to know where they can get tested, they can call 215-985-AIDS, and they can tell you the closest place to get tested right in your community. Testing's critical. When we want to make testing routine, and we've made great strides in getting more people tested.
John, is this part of what a doctor should be asking every patient who walks in, especially when, as Rob says, once you have it in the community, it's moving?
You can't test too many people would be my approach to this. Test everybody that comes through your office. You know, docs think of patients in their office as being, in a friendly way, captured. So it's an opportunity to test them for both HIV and hepatitis C, to immunize them appropriately, to talk about a variety of health issues. So I use the opportunity to do those things. I also just want to point out, while we're talking about the epidemic and the epidemiology, that the incidence of HIV in intravenous drug users has gone down in Philadelphia primarily because of needle exchange programs. Some of our conservative politicians have felt that this actually encourages drug abuse. Their data is absolutely wrong. And from a health perspective, it has dramatically decreased the incidence of HIV in that population. So we've done well there.
You know, Rob, I think we were discussing this, and I asked if the opioid crisis had created a new population for this, but with needle sharing there. But on the other hand, are we seeing people who are less likely to protect themselves?
Right. So what we've seen in Philadelphia is a decline, as John said, in the number of new infections in the IV drug using community as a result of good needle exchange program and our friends at Prevention Point who led that charge. Unfortunately, the opioid epidemic, we are starting to see an increase again in new infections among IV drug users. We started to see a spike this past year. And so we really, you know, I think one of the things we have to constantly be vigilant. We have to learn from our history. And I think we too often don't learn from our history. It's one of the reasons we have our 1981 until it's over timeline that we take out the colleges and universities and community events. And it's a walk through history of the epidemic because we want to be sure that, A, we remind people who've lived through the epidemic of where we've been and help them understand where we're at. But also for young people to see the history so that, you know, we don't repeat this with either HIV or another epidemic that comes along.
Well, when I mentioned it's not just needle transmission, it's the risky behavior. Are people aware of how it is transmitted? When I asked about what exactly is age for that definition again, we accept this. We're all mature. We've been around long enough that we remember all of these things. But for so many people, do they even know what behaviors can lead to an exposure or an infection?
I think we do have a we have educated, the information is out there now, and people have heard it. The issue is whether they believe it and whether they take it and personalize it for their own behavior. So they know, I think we've done a good job over the last 35 years of getting people to know how HIV is transmitted. We still have a lot of stigma. We still have a lot of misconceptions. But it's not that the people haven't heard the information. They just don't want to accept it. And I think there's a big difference there. So
if also I could just jump in, I think when people are having sex and, we're a mature audience here, people's heads aren't well screwed onto their bodies, at least for a short period of time, number one. Number two, there's substance abuse, alcohol, that's often involved in sexual encounters. So again, people aren't necessarily thinking as clearly as they would under normal circumstances. So people let their guard down, and people get infected. And they not only get infected with HIV, but they're also infected with hepatitis C and syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia
or they have an unplanned pregnancy.
Sorry that I left that out, but yes.
But, I often say we don't look at somebody who has an unplanned pregnancy in the same way we look at somebody who had an unplanned contracted HIV in an unplanned way. So how do we, we have a lot of stigma associated with people, contracting HIV, but we don't place those same stigma on the same behaviors that would lead to an unplanned pregnancy. So I think, we have a long way to go to ending the stigma around HIV.
Well, you mentioned Hep C, and I actually wrote that down, but then I wrote down STDs. Are we seeing an increase in sexually transmitted disease?
Yes, particularly syphilis in Philadelphia. In the gay population in the city, it's, I don't know if it's epidemic, but in our office, we're seeing probably a new case of syphilis every 2 to 4 weeks. In fact, there's been a shortage of penicillin to treat it, and it's become quite a problem. So yes, there's always a steady flow of chlamydia, gonorrhea, warts, trichomonas, and there's probably about 3 million people living in this country with hepatitis C, not all of it acquired through sex. In the earlier years before we had actually identified what hepatitis C was, it was easily acquired in blood transfusions. But anyway, there's about 3 million people with it now, and it's quite curable if you get tested and treat it.
And I would have assumed that because of the AIDS crisis that so many of us, we believe in protection. And that's going to lead to my next question, actually, though. But first, I got to say that you're listening to Philadelphia Focus. I'm Laura Lewis. With us today is Dr. John Stern, infectious disease specialist at Pennsylvania Hospital and the executive director of AIDS Fund Philly, Rob Reichert. And if you'd like more information, you can always go to AIDSFundPhilly.org. You will find information and links to absolutely everything you need to know anywhere you may be. It will give you a referral. You will be able to find everything. everything that you need to know right there, AIDSFundPhilly.org. They have amazing partners. You'll also find links that you can go to learn more about everything that they do, including the amazing AIDS Walk Philly coming up October 20th. And I just mentioned protection, and we talked about prevention. Now we seem to be talking about treatment. And when we talk about treatment, we're talking about treatment being the prevention. And we're moving it away from protect yourself to protect others.
Well, I think that's partially true. We also have new prevention methods for people to use. And we, you know, that's PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, where people can take one pill a day and reduce their risk by 99% of contracting the virus.
You brought it right back around. So it is, you've got to look out for yourself and look out for
yes.
others.
Okay. And unfortunately, only about a third of the gay and bisexual men who are at high risk for HIV are currently on PrEP. And so one of our goals is to make sure that that information gets out, that you know, we destigmatize the use of PrEP so that people don't feel embarrassed to talk to their doctors about it, and also make sure that the medical community knows about PrEP and is willing to prescribe it for their patients. So I think, you know, there's a lot of things that still have to happen with that. But then you mentioned treatment as prevention. We now know, without a doubt, that if somebody's got an undetectable viral load, they will not pass the virus on to somebody else. We call this U equals U, undetectable equals uninfectious. And, you know, we talk about this as treatment as prevention, and we're starting to see a decline in a number of new cases. And I think as we get people, more people into treatment and care, you know, there's less likelihood that they're going to pass the virus on to other people. And again, that's why it's important for people to get tested, to know their status, not only protect their own health, but to protect the health of their partners.
John, do you want to talk about treatment and talk about what is available to someone right now? Does age and talk about gender as well? We mentioned unplanned pregnancy. What about women and this treatment? We usually just hear it discussed in relation to men.
That's a big subject. Let's break it down. First, let's talk about PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. The current guidelines are to use Truvada or Descovy, which is a pill with two different HIV medications in it. They are quite safe, easily taken once a day, have really no long-term side effects that we are aware of at this point. Truvada has been available to physicians and patients for at least 14 years now with a good track record. It can cause some kidney problems and some bone issues, but well-tolerated. It is expensive, costing in the range of, I believe, $12,000 to $15,000 a year. The good news is that insurance, both commercial and the government plans, are reimbursing patients for using it. And if somebody is not inclined to use pre-exposure prophylaxis daily, which is ideal, it can be used analogous to the morning after pill. Take two pills the day you have sex, unsafe sex, and a tablet the day after, and then the subsequent day. The effectiveness of doing it as a morning after pill is only about 70%, however. So it's really important to share with your physician your risk status so that they can get you on the right meds. Number two, let's talk about therapy for infected patients. We're now using two drug regimens, three drug regimens. They're all combined primarily into one pill, again, taken daily, quite safe, good for men and women, although there's a little bit of data that a drug called dolutegravir may just slightly increase neural tube defects, that's spina bifida, in pregnant women who take the drug during the first trimester. So at this point, I don't want to get too technical, but women who are of childbearing age considering pregnancy should discuss an appropriate HIV regimen under that set of circumstances. I also would like to point out that the mathematicians state that if we can get the entire world's 30 to 40 million people who are infected with HIV on effective therapy, this virus will disappear from the earth in 60 years, three generations. We did get rid of smallpox. We almost got rid of polio. We could get rid of HIV if we had the finances, the political will, and the ability to deliver appropriate medications in the developing world, as well as the United States and Europe.
Is there a cure?
Not yet.
Obviously not yet, but is that even in the vernacular right now? Because we talk about treatments, so.
Absolutely. Again, not to get too technical, but the reason that HIV is difficult to cure is that the HIV virus, the RNA, gets actually inserted into the host's, the human's DNA. It's almost like inserting a link in a chain and then welding it so that it's part of the old chain. So it's always been difficult to get that viral piece out of the chain and cure the patient of it. So current research is working on ways to sort of stimulate those bits of DNA, the viral DNA that are now linked into one's own DNA, out so that they can be susceptible to the medications and be killed, essentially. So I'm actually optimistic that in the next decade we may get close to this. I'm much less optimistic about an effective vaccine. We've been at it for 30 years, and just about every potential vaccine has either failed or not been particularly effective.
And, of course, all of this, everything depends now upon compliance with treatment, knowing your status, and then compliance. And here I'm going to go into a little bit of a discussion that I keep hearing lately about, you know, compliance implies that if you're not taking your medication, it's a matter of choice. When a lot of times staying on treatment means you have housing security, you have food, you're not fighting an employer, you have a wheelchair, et cetera. And that's where AIDS Fund Philly comes in.
Yeah, well, thank you, Laurie. Our goal is to keep people in care. And our method in this multi-pronged approach to keeping people in care is that we provide small emergency grants to people living with HIV when their financial situation could get in the way of them maintaining their health. So it could be getting a wheelchair repaired. It could be they need a cane, a $50 cane, so that they can get around. It may be that they need that they've been forced to move. We have a gentleman we did a $500 grant for recently who had a stroke. When he came out of the physical rehab, he went back to his apartment. He was on a second floor apartment. He had to be carried upstairs and then was not able to leave his apartment. He had to move to get into a more accessible, but he didn't. It was an unexpected expense. He needed $500 to help with get his security deposit into an accessible apartment. So these are the things that, you know, how do you maintain your health or your well-being if you're you need a physically accessible apartment? How do you maintain your health or well-being if your wheelchair doesn't work? How do you maintain your health and well-being if you don't have a cane? How do you maintain your health and well-being if you don't have an ID that is the key to even getting into treatment? These are things that we help people with. Last year, we did 295 grants. They are small. They average just $422, but they have a huge impact on people's lives.
And of course, it takes funding for that. And so many, you know, you might be in treatment somewhere, but money usually is not allowed to be spent if you have amazing partners, but of course they might prescribe the pill, but they cannot in their budgeting afford to give somebody the cab fare to get back and forth, right, et cetera. And that's where you step in. And that's what the AIDS Walk does each year. It provides the funds for this kind of
these emergency grants.
Emergency grants.
Yes. AIDS Walk Philly is Sunday, October 20th. It's our 33rd annual. We will be out there raising funds for the most vulnerable members of our community so that we have the ability to provide them these small grants that are designed to keep them in care. when they have an emergency situation.
And talk about the event.
Well, the event is, as I said, this is our 33rd annual. We have many traditions from the past 33 years. We will have a display of the AIDS Memorial quilt. 25 blocks of the quilt will be on display at the Art Museum on Sunday, October 20th. The quilt is a beautiful memorial to those we've lost to the epidemic. We always want to remember and honor the memory of those we lost to the epidemic. We also always start our day with a reading of names, again, to honor and remember those we've lost to the epidemic. Everything kicks off at 7 a.m. We have our opening ceremonies at 8 a.m. And the walk kicks off at 8:30. It's a 5K walk on Martin Luther King Drive. So it's up along the Schuylkill with great views of the Boathouse Row. Always a beautiful fall day, so you have the fall foliage, and you're out there with thousands of other people who also care about this epidemic and ending this epidemic.
And you can register on site, but you can also go to AIDSWalkPhilly.org and sign up ahead of time, form a team, or just show up and walk and raise funds.
And raise funds. The funds are critical. Everybody who raises $50 will get a T-shirt. Those who raise $500 get our AIDS Walk Philly hoodie. And then those who raise $1,000 or more will get a jacket, an AIDS Walk Philly 2019 jacket. But, you know, we know that those people who are raising those funds aren't doing it for the T-shirt or the jacket. They're doing it because they care about our friends, family, and neighbors living with HIV here in the region.
You know what? We didn't talk numbers, and we are out of time. But what kind of numbers are we looking at?
Well, in Philadelphia, we have about 19,500 people living with HIV in Philadelphia. There's an additional about 7,000 or so in the surrounding eight counties. So in the region, we have about 27,000 people living with HIV today.
That is no small number. Parting words?
If I can just weigh in, not only is it important to look at the science and available pharmaceuticals for this infection, but we need to talk about what's going on in Washington. We have an election in a year, and for those people who are concerned about HIV, they need to get out and vote for an administration that has consistent views with your own, and I wish you the best of luck.
Rob, parting words?
Please come out and join us on Sunday, October 20th for AIDS Walk Philly 2019. We'll be out there with our friends, family, and neighbors walking to support those most vulnerable living with HIV.
Be a lifeline is your theme.
Be a lifeline to a person living with HIV.
And of course, more information about absolutely everything that we talked about is found at AIDSFundPhilly.org. About the work that it does here in the region, information about testing, information about everything that we discussed today. And here's where I say thank you to Dr. John Stern, infectious disease specialist. He is with Pennsylvania Hospital, and Rob Reichert, who is the executive director for AIDS Fund Philly. Thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Philadelphia Focus.